Kill Radio Weekly News and Review. I'm your announcer, DJ Shy John. Recorded today, January 1st of the year 2013. For the latest in the past week's news, we're starting today with the Harper's Weekly Review. Dated January 1st, 2013. U.S. Senate leaders reached a tentative last-minute deal to avert the fiscal cliff of automatic tax increases and spending cuts scheduled for January 1st, though not in time for the agreement to be approved by members of the House of Representatives, who were set to vote as soon as Tuesday afternoon. The deal permanently increases capital gains, dividend, and income tax rates on individuals making more than $400,000 per year and couples making more than $450,000. Begins phasing out certain tax deductions on incomes above $250,000 and provides for an additional 2 months to negotiate $110 billion in cuts to military and domestic spending programs. Senate Democrats had briefly withdrawn from the talks after Republicans proposed to recalculate inflation in such a way as to lower benefit payments from entitlement programs, prompting Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican Kentucky, to ask Vice President Joe Biden to help restart the negotiations. "I need a dance partner," said McConnell. Congressional aides played the Beatles' Come Together for House Republicans. Starbucks urged baristas to write Come Together on coffee cups at its Washington, D.C. franchise, and Obama signed an executive order increasing the pay of members of Congress. The Constitutional Council of France struck down a 75% tax on incomes over $1 million a year that had been scheduled to take effect on January 1st. North Korean Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un called for an end to confrontation between his country and South Korea. And a newly released interview revealed Yoko Ono to have blamed the breakup of the Beatles on Paul McCartney's predominance in the band. Police in India charged 6 men with murder hours after the death of a 23-year-old woman who had been gang-raped and thrown from a moving bus. "This is the story of every Indian woman," said a protester. Another Indian gang rape victim committed suicide after police pressured her to drop her accusations and marry one of her attackers. In New York City, a woman killed an Indian immigrant by shoving him over the edge of a subway platform. "I pushed a Muslim off the track," she told police, "because I hate Hindus." Russia put whistleblower Sergei Magnitsky, who died while in police custody in 2009, on trial for fraud. Magnitsky's case has been moved to January, announced the district court on the first day of hearings, due to the absence of lawyers for the defense. Russian President Vladimir Putin signed a law passed in retaliation for a new U.S. human rights law named after Magnitsky that prohibits Americans from adopting Russian children. 2 Los Angeles residents turned in rocket launchers as a part of a no-questions-asked gun buyback program. 200 Utah teachers took a concealed carry firearms course in response to the recent elementary school shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, and scientists were studying the DNA of Adam Lanza, the Newtown shooter, in search of a gene that made him evil. A man set fire to his home on Christmas Eve in Webster, New York, then shot at the responding firefighters, killing 2, before shooting himself in the head. A neighbor, whose home burned down as the fires spread, vowed to rebuild. "I really want to live on the bay," she said. "He's gone now, right?" The German magazine Der Spiegel accidentally published on its website an obituary for colorless former President George H.W. Bush, whose condition was in fact improving after he was admitted to intensive care with a fever, and H. Norman Schwarzkopf, the Army general who led U.S. forces in the first Gulf War, died at 78. In Syria, a general tasked with preventing military defections defected. Mexican Marines killed four men who were trying to steal the dead body of a Zeta drug cartel leader known as the Pokemon. Children sledding in Wyoming discovered the frozen, dead body of a homeless man who was unknowingly the potential heir to a $19 million fortune. China passed a law allowing parents to sue their adult children for not visiting them frequently enough, and a Filipino bishop announced his opposition to a reproduction health bill aimed at curbing overpopulation, arguing that a larger population could better care for the country's elderly. A novovirus outbreak caused hundreds of passengers on an exclusive Caribbean Christmas cruise to be stricken with diarrhea, nausea, and vomiting. In England, two elves were arrested for assault, and a Garden Center Santa was fired for telling children he wasn't real. The baby Jesus was stolen from a live nativity scene outside a funeral home in Mount Healthy, Ohio. And a woman in Damascus, Oregon, told reporters about a letter written by a worker in a Chinese forced labor camp that she'd found in a box of decorations from Kmart's Totally Ghoul holiday line. "If you occasionally buy this product," wrote the laborer, "please kindly resend this letter to the World Human Rights Organization." This article by Jacob Z. Gross. Next in the news this morning, something probably everybody should know about. This is from Zimbio.com. The article is about opium. It's entitled, "Did the U.S. Invasion of Afghanistan Cause a Heroin Epidemic in Europe and America?" This is by Thomas Rutterbush. Since the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, the heroin output has increased over 5,000%. More than a decade since the U.S. invaded Afghanistan to destroy al-Qaeda and punish the Taliban, the U.S. and NATO occupation drags on even as the war begins to wind down, and Afghanistan's status as the world's number one opium poppy producer remains unchallenged. Afghan opium production started with the U.S.-backed overthrow of the secular Afghan government in 1978 and grew steadily with the consequent civil war, the Russian invasion, and the U.S.-backed religious-based resistance. Afghan opium production increased further after the departure of the Russians. However, in 2000, several years after they captured Kabul, the Taliban banned opium production, slashing Afghan opium production from about 76% of world production in 2000 to 6% in 2001. In the aftermath of the 2001 U.S. bombing of Afghanistan, the British government was entrusted by the leading industrial nations to carry out a drug eradication program, which would theoretically allow Afghan farmers to get out of poppy cultivation and switch to alternative crops. The British were working in close liaison with the U.S. DEA's Operation Containment out of Kabul. The British crop eradication program was an apparent smokescreen, considering that since October 2001, opium poppy cultivation has flourished. The presence of occupation forces in Afghanistan did not result in the eradication of poppy cultivation, as lawmakers had promised. It did exactly the opposite. The Taliban prohibition had caused the beginning of a heroin shortage in Europe by the end of 2001, the UNODC acknowledged. However, immediately following the October 2001 invasion, opium markets were restored and opium prices spiraled. By 2002, the opium price was almost 10 times higher than in 2000. Heroin is a multi-million dollar business protected by powerful international interests, which requires a stable, steady, and secure product flow. One of the secret objectives of the war was to restore the CIA-sponsored drug trade to its historical norms and establish control over the smuggling routes. Within a year of the U.S. alliance invasion, the Afghan opium production skyrocketed from 6% of world production in 2001 to 74% in 2002, 93% in 2006, 95% in 2007, and 94% in 2008. According to Glenn Greenway, the Drug Truth Network reported September 15, 2008, Afghan heroin output has increased a staggering 5,000% since the U.S. invasion 7 years ago. I would guess this percentage is even larger today. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said recently at an international conference in Vienna that Afghanistan will never be stable unless it tackles its drug problem. In 2007, Afghanistan supplied 93% of the world's opium. According to the U.S. State Department, illicit poppy production, meanwhile, brings $4 billion into Afghanistan, or more than half the country's total economy of $7.5 billion, according to the United Nations Office of Drug Control, UNODC. It also represents about half of the economy of Pakistan and of the ISI in particular. Destroying the labs has always been an obvious option, but for years America refused to do so for political reasons. In 2001, the Taliban and bin Laden were estimated by the CIA to be earning up to 10% of Afghanistan's drug revenues, then estimated at between 6.5 and 10 billion U.S. dollars a year. This income of perhaps $1 billion was less than that earned by Pakistan's intelligence agency, ISI, parts of which had become the key to the drug trade in Central Asia. The UN Drug Control Program estimated in 1999 that the ISI made around $2.5 billion annually from the sale of illegal drugs. At the start of the U.S. offensive in 2001, according to Ahmed Rashid, the Pentagon had a list of 25 or more drug labs and warehouses in Afghanistan, but refused to bomb them because some belonged to the CIA's new Northern Alliance allies. Rashid was told by UNODC officials that the Americans knew far more about the drug labs than they claimed to know, and the failure to bomb them was a major setback to the counter-narcotics effort. James Risen reports that the ongoing refusal to pursue the targeted drug labs came from neocons at the top of America's national security bureaucracy, including even Donald Rumsfeld. These men were preserving a pattern of drug trafficking protection racket in Washington that dates back all the way to World War II. Thanks primarily to the CIA-backed anti-Soviet campaign of the 1980s, Afghanistan today is a drug-corrupted and heroin-ravaged society, from the heads of state all the way down to the junkies on the streets. Governing Afghans are likely to become involved in the drug traffic sooner or later, just as the FARC in Colombia and the Communist Party in Myanmar have evolved in time from revolutionary movements into drug trafficking organizations. The situation in Pakistan is not much different. The U.S. mainstream media have never mentioned the February 23rd report in the London Sunday Times, and that Asif al-Zardari, now the Pakistani Prime Minister, was once caught in a DEA drug sting. Important as heroin may have become to the Afghan and Pakistani political economies, the local proceeds are only a small share of the global heroin traffic. According to the UN, the ultimate value in world markets in 2007 of Afghanistan's $4 billion opium crop was about $110 billion. This estimate is probably too high, but even if the ultimate value was as low as $40 billion, this would mean that 90% of the profit was earned by forces outside of Afghanistan. It has been estimated that 80% or more of the profits from the traffic are reaped in the countries of consumption. The UNODC executive director, Antonio Maria Costa, has reported that money made in illicit drug trade has been used to keep banks afloat in the global financial crisis. Since the time of invasion of Afghanistan, the opium production is given a boost by United States and its powerful Afghan government. Hamid Karzai and his clan are heavily involved in this business. This being understood, they have taken measures to cultivate opium, provided support for trafficking with Tajikistan in a legal way, and this has resulted as an increase in use of opium around the globe and has especially hit Russia and Europe. In the years since the U.S.-led invasion of Afghanistan, Russia has been flooded with heroin. The drug has crept along a trail stretching from Afghanistan through Tajikistan and other Central Asian nations and over the Russian border, turning the country into the world's top consumer of heroin, the Russian government says. The drug has spread like fire through a country uniquely unqualified to cope with its dangers. Narcotics were largely absent during Soviet times, and most people are still unaware of the risk of heroin addiction, even as an estimated 83 Russians a day die by overdosing on the drug. Official statistics show Russia estimates that one in every 50 people of working age is addicted to heroin. South Wales has seen a jump of 180% in heroin addiction rates since the invasion of Afghanistan. In 2008, the EU estimated that a young European died every hour from a drug overdose. Also, folks, it's not just opium coming out of Afghanistan. According to the UNODC World Drug Report 2011, Afghanistan is also among the significant cannabis resin-producing countries, producing somewhere between 1,500 and 3,500 metric tons of hash in 2010, with no reason to think it has changed dramatically in 2011. That brings in somewhere between 85 million and 265 million at the farm gate. A decade after the U.S. invasion, Afghanistan remains the world's largest opium producer, by far, and possibly the world's largest cannabis producer. Given the crucial role these drug crops play in the Afghan economy, there is little reason to think anything is going to change anytime soon. Again, written by Tom Redderbush. Okay, now I have one more here for you. This is from HuffPost Politics, dated January 1st. Michael Moore writes my New Year's resolutions. Happy New Year! Have you made your resolutions for 2013? Here are mine. Number one, learn the names of the people two doors down from me and invite them over for dinner. Number two, learn how to make dinner. Number three, buy a gun. Stroke it, squeeze it, hold it, love it, shoot it. Ah, buy more guns. Stroke them. Number four, stop saying, I support the troops. I don't. I used to. I understand why so many enlisted after 9/11. Sadly, many of them were then trapped and sent off to invade Iraq. I felt for all of them. I understood those who joined because of a lousy economy, but at some point, all individuals must answer for their actions. And now that we know our military leaders do things that have nothing to do with defending our lives, why would anyone sign up for this rogue organization? Number five, apologize for number four. I have enormous respect for anyone who would offer to sacrifice their life to defend my right to live. Is there any greater gift one can give another? It's not the troops' fault. They've sent to invade other countries for dubious reasons and outright lies. It's our responsibility to prevent this, to elect representatives who believe in peace, and to only put our troops in harm's way when it's absolutely necessary. My uncle was killed in World War II. Today would have been his 90th birthday. My dad still misses him. Our family has served this country in the military since the Revolutionary War. None of them watch Fox News. Number six, drink more water. Number seven, wear color. Number eight, find the best person who can run for and win the governor's chair here in Michigan in 2014. Work every day to win back the Michigan House and Senate from its Republican majority. Number nine, read more fiction. Support my local indie bookstore. Help people create little free libraries and Put one up in front of our theater in Traverse City. Don't use glowing screens to read books. Write the next one. Number 10. Keep walking, dude. That's my list. Send me yours via Twitter and Facebook. He says, click here to join me on the walk. So you can find this on Huffington Post. Let's be kind to each other in the coming year. And let's encourage Obama to act, to make history, and to be remembered as one of our greatest presidents. Here's hoping for a peaceful 2013. Follow Michael Moore on Twitter, www.twitter.com/MMFLINT. Michael Moore Flint. Oh, and we have reached the end of the January 1st Kill Radio Weekly News and Review. Ladies and gentlemen, I would echo Michael Moore's sentiment. Please be kind to each other in the coming week and the coming year. Be patient with your children. Show love to your fellow man. And stay out of the news. Thank you.